Okay, question in the back here. Okay, if I understand the question correctly, what you're asking is if the contractor interpreted something different than the CA believed it said, what happens then? Okay. It's a good question and one that happens frequently, as you know. The short answer is the CA gets to make the call. Then if the contractor is unhappy with the CA's decision, and that there are some significant cost consequences to that, then the CA can file a dispute, or sorry, the contractor can file a dispute notice, which will set forth why the contractor believes the CA made the wrong call. And at that point, then it gets into the dispute resolution mechanism, and the problem gets solved by somebody else. But the thing to understand is, the CA always has jurisdiction to tell the contractor what to do. The question is whether or not the contractor has to do it at no additional reimbursement. Whether or not it has to be done, it's never a question. You always have to follow the CA's instructions. You can argue about what that costs and who pays it later on. Does that answer your question? The contractor gets to say, this is how I interpreted it, and this is how I bid it. Correct. If the CA says, well, I don't care, I want this one, then the contractor is going to be entitled to some reimbursement.
Correct. So that's different than interpreting it differently in the same
context. Well, that's really a matter of something that would have been a factor when bidding. When you get into the question of the job, the CA may say, well, this specification means this, and the contractor says, no, it means that. That's where you still have to follow the CA's instruction, and you can argue about the cost implications later. Okay. All right. Moving on to the players and their roles. Let's see if this works. All right. I said in the beginning that the main goal of the MMCD was to try and bring the three parties together, the owner, the contractor, and the contract administrator, so that they work as a team to accomplish the project at the most cost-effective and efficient manner possible. And as part of that, what we try and do is we try and increase the areas of overlaps where goals coincide. So, for example, my little pointer's not dragging down here. The owner's goals. There are a number of goals, some that relate strictly to the owner, some where there's an overlap between the owner and the contractor, some where there's an overlap between the owner and the CA, and then there's the sweet spot in the middle
where the goals are common to all three parties. And so our objective is to enlarge this area here by writing documents carefully that maximize the chances for people to want to work together. So just looking at a few examples here. Owners looking to get good value for the money spent, easy long-term maintenance, good documentation for finance and engineering, and to minimize taxpayer inconvenience. Those are things that relate pretty much uniquely to the owner. They will have some goals that overlap with the CA. They want to manage the risk to limit it to what the contract intended. They want to get fair value in the administration of the contract. And the owner will have some goals that overlap with the contractor to minimize tendering hassle, maximize tendering success. Both parties want success in tendering. But some examples of things that all three agree on. Everybody wants the thing to come in on budget, on schedule, without accidents. They want to have pride in the job when it's done. They want to enhance working relationships for future work and reputations. These are things that everybody can agree are good outcomes, if at all possible. Another example of an overlap would be between the CA and the contractor. They both are looking to minimize project administration hassles and costs. So the more we can do as an association to create overlaps, the more successful everybody will be, and we'll be able to judge ourselves as a success. So let's look at the roles that the owner plays. And we had a question earlier about what can the owner get involved in. Well, the owner acquires or owns the site and all its risks to start with. The owner arranges for design, for financing and payment. The owner is responsible to get some permits, which we call owner permits, things that take a long time or require owner input are such as fisheries permits. The owner's responsible for things like utility moves and other work by third parties, perhaps even work by its own forces to sanitize a drinking water main. The owner arranges for and engages the contract administrator. And they can do that by appointing someone from their own staff or hiring someone from a consulting firm. The owner is also responsible to tender and to select the successful tenderer. And in doing so, approve the subcontractors that are to be used and the superintendent that will be in charge. The contractor has a different role, of course. They're awarded the contract based on the tender they submit. Normally, they need the lowest price, but not always. The experience of the firm and the superintendent and the choice of the subcontractors can be factored into the owner's award decision. The language that the MMCD provides allows the owner to have that flexibility and to determine that perhaps a small difference between the low bid and the second low is more than outweighed by some of these other experience factors. The contractor can propose alternative tenders. In other words, they can suggest something that wasn't tendered. But the owner can only accept it if the contractor happened to be the one that would have been selected otherwise if the alternative had not been proposed. So that's a very stringent rule. It's difficult for both contractors and owners to comply with. But I don't think it causes problems very often, because in this type of business, it's not there's usually not a lot of alternatives that the owner hasn't already thought of. Gets tougher once the contractor's in place. Once the contract's been awarded, the contractor is committed to strict compliance with all contract provisions. This is one of our violations of our own say-it-once rule. This is so important that we put it into Clause 1.1 of the agreement, as well as the very first clause dealing with the contractor's responsibilities in the general conditions. This is the job the contractor accepted, the contractor bid on and was accepted to do. The contractor has full responsibility for site safety, and they take on the prime contractor's role. Now, the prime contractor is a designation set out by WorkSafe BC for sites where more than one contractor is working. It allows owners to designate one particular contractor to be the prime contractor for WCB purposes on that site. And it's a very onerous role, and there are a lot of ways that it can't be transferred cleanly between the owner and the contractor, or that if it is transferred initially, it can bounce back because the owners haven't followed through on the things they have to do. But it's a, if in place, if put in place by the owner, as would normally be done with the standard MMCD language, it makes this prime, general contractor the prime contractor for the site and responsible for the safety of everybody working on that site between the notice to proceed and the issuance of the certificate of substantial performance. The contractor has the full choice of the methods of construction that are to be used, and is responsible to acquire whatever permits that entails. Contractor is also obligated to manage the performance of all subcontractors to meet the same requirements as if the general contractor were doing it themselves. Questions come in. Can contractor change a subcontractor during the construction? Yes, but that requires the approval of the owner through the CA. It is expected that when the owner makes the award decision, that they have evaluated the subcontractors being proposed and can in fact require a change prior to award. And because they've had that ability and they've used that criteria in making the award decision, then they expect that contract subcontractor will be in place. And if the general wishes to change, then they have to get the okay from the owner. Second question, is there a selection criteria that provides the weight that low bid versus contractor or subs experience will have? No, there is not. We don't get into how that decision will be made. That will be up to the award team dealing with the particulars of every set of circumstances. What we've done is we've given the owner the ability to factor in other things beyond the low price when making that decision. And both the general and the subcontractors involved in tendering understand that that's the rules of the game and that they have agreed to those rules by tendering. Does that prevent the owner from being challenged? Absolutely not. So an owner who does not go with a low bid will have to have some transparent and uniform criteria that have been applied when making a choice for other than the low bid. All we've done is say that low bid is not entirely the determining factor. So is that fair to other contractors? Sure. It's the owner's money, in effect the taxpayer's money that's being spent. It's the owner's prerogative to get the best deal that they can for the money that they're spending. And if that means spending a bit more money to get a much more qualified contractor, a much more experienced contractor, then they make that business decision and they have to stand by it. It doesn't, as I said, it doesn't mean they won't be challenged on it. But the fact is, owners have the ability to do that, both through the language that the MMCD provides and some case law that that supports the general concept. Not, it hasn't been tested with our language. Another question, is there wording to ensure that the CA gets paid by the owner? Well, there's two aspects to that. First of all, to be clear, it is the owner that pays the CA. It's not a shared cost. The owner is entirely responsible for paying the CA. There is no language, there is no language in the MMCD to deal with that because that's an entirely different contract. Remember I said earlier, we have a client-consultant agreement. This is the contract, or a contract, that would engage the CA and determine the responsibility for payment. The MMCD contract is between the owner and the contractor and deals with payment between those two parties only. Does the owner need to list their selection criteria waiting in the tender documents? No, the owner does not have to do that. However, it has to be done in a uniform manner and a transparent manner. In other words, owners that go through that process have to be able to show that it was done fairly. If you're in a very complicated contract, such as the Ministry of Highways uses when they tender for maintenance contractors, they set out a whole bunch of criteria and weighting factors. But that's a much more broad-based contract than we're dealing with here. And so typically, owners don't set out a weighting criteria ahead of time. If they're that concerned, what they may do is to set up a pre-qualification list and only issue tenders to those people who pre-qualify. And by the way, if they do that, then they have to change this language because once they've pre-approved people, they cannot use anything but low cost when making the award decision because the mere fact of saying you're pre-qualified says we're willing to accept your price if you're the low bidder. Okay, if the owner doesn't pay the CA, can the CA withdraw services? Of course the CA can withdraw services. If the owner is not paying the CA, that's a commercial matter between the two parties. However, the contract requires the owner to have a CA in place. And if CA number one resigns, moves away, or whatever, then the owner must immediately, in consultation with the general contractor, appoint another CA. The job is not supposed to run without a CA because there are so many decisions and approvals that are required to be done by the CA that you can't have these jobs run without one. There was a circumstance in the Lower Mainland where the job ran for 18 months without a CA, and despite repeated pleas by the contractor to address an overrun situation, the quantities overran by something like 1,800% on one item, and the owner got a huge bill at the end, and it became a significant dispute to be settled, and it was strictly because the owner had not replaced the CA when the CA left for whatever reason, and that caused immense problems. So yes, the CA can withdraw if they're not being paid, then why would they continue to work? But that doesn't prevent or doesn't mean the owner can continue the job without a CA. So as I said, it is a mandatory position. The CA must be in place at the time of the notice of award, no later, and the CA is finished at the certificate of total performance. Beyond total performance, any work that's done during the maintenance period is done by someone who may have been the CA or may not, but whoever it is does not have the CA's authority during the maintenance period. The CA's authority is, in a sense, absolute but very constrained. The CA can generate instructions, requirements, and a whole bunch of things, providing that the CA can point to a clause in the contract that says, I'm allowed to do this. And when I teach the CA course, I sort of tell them to tattoo that on their eyelids, that if you can't point to a clause that gives you the authority to do something you want to do, you better go back and look again. And if you can't find it, you better not do it, because you're opening up yourself and the owner to risk. So it's really deep authority. It's very comprehensive, but it's absolutely constrained by the language of the documents. So we specifically designed the role of the CA to avoid the previous context where the engineer was God. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there were a lot of contracts put out by groups like the railroads, by BC Hydro, by the Ministry of Transportation, where the engineer had the ultimate authority. There was no appeal. And that led to an abuse of power. And it led to a lot of disputes and a lot of legal cases. And it was the recognition of that cause that we designed this document differently. The other thing about having the engineer as God is that the expectation is the engineer could tell the contractor to do anything and not necessarily pay for it. And so we said that that just attracts liability back to the owner, because then you end up in lawsuits. So we wanted to make sure that it's clear to the CA that they do not run the job. They do not instruct the workers. They do not instruct the subcontractors. It's really unfortunate, but there's no way around it, that the CA has a three-way conflicting role. Number one, the CA represents the owner, is hired by the owner to ensure that the contract is built according to the terms and conditions of the document. In other words, to ensure that the owner gets what they pay for. But under our GC 3.6.1, the CA has been designated as the impartial arbiter of the performance of both parties to the contract. In other words, in the first instance, all decisions are made by the CA on the basis of whether either party is complying with the contract. And that means that at times, the CA gets put into a position where they have to make a decision which will be contrary to the owner's interests. I'll give you an example of that in a few minutes. Finally, the CA may be, often is, the representative of the firm that did the design. And if the design is defective, then it's a problem because the CA has an obligation to see that the assumptions and design intent is complied with. But if the contract language does not allow for that, if it's deficient in some way, if there's a drawing missing, or there's details missing, or there's something that doesn't work, then we say it's not the contractor's problem. That's a matter between the owner and the CA. And given that the contractor is just dealing with what he's been presented, the CA may be obligated to address issues and generate change orders which will cost the owner more money. And it's not the owner's fault. It was something that the design firm missed or got wrong. But that's an issue between the design firm and the owner. It's not a matter that should worry the contractor. Let me give you an example from my experience. We were building some beams for BC Ferries, and the design called for these big beams. They were about 6 feet high, 80 to 90 feet long. They had parallel stiffener plates every 10 or 15 feet. And the weld detail was to weld the full perimeter, both sides of each of these stiffener plates. And if you think about it for a minute, you'll realize that we had a great deal of difficulty finding welders that would entomb themselves for the benefit of BC Ferries. This was a design problem that could not be fixed by the contractor. It was a deficiency in the design. Now, there were a number of ways that it might have been addressed with access hatches, either holes cut out through the center of the stiffening plates or access hatches cut into the side of the beams. In the end, that's what we had to do, but the owner was on the hook for those extra costs because that wasn't part of the design we bid on. And it put the engineer in that case, wasn't an MMCD contract, into a terrific conflict of interest because not only did they have to go to the owner and say, sorry, we've got to pay the contractor a bunch more money for this, but they had to go back to their own office and say, you guys screwed up and it's going to cost this much money. So we can't eliminate the problem of the three-way conflict of interest with the CA. All we can do is attempt to make it clear to owners and CAs, and to contractors for that matter, that the CA is in this position and you have to recognize it and you have to support the CA when he gets into that position and you have to deal with it when it happens. So what are the functions of the CA? First of all, the CA is the focal point for all contract communications. Everything between the contractor and the owner is supposed to go through the CA. There's one exception to that, which is a reasonable exception, and that is if the contractor has a problem with the performance of the CA, then the owner and the contractor can talk directly. The CA is also responsible to authorize payments. And as I told you right at the beginning, one of the parameters that we use is the CA's signature is good as gold. When the CA signs off a progress payment, whatever that dollar amount is supposed to be unchangeable. It's not supposed to be subject to any further review or offset by the owner or the purchasing department or the financing department or anybody else, because the owner has given the CA the authority to make that call. The CA is responsible to give instructions, to issue field memos for clarification, to negotiate and to authorize change orders, to evaluate quality compliance. The difficult point here is to make sure everybody understands that the CA is not responsible for the quality of the job. The specific language requires the CA to check the job for general conformance. And this comes back to our expectation that nothing gets the contractor off the hook for the quality of the job or the completeness of the job other than a signed document by the CA that says you don't have to do this or you can do it this way. Barring that, the contractor always remains responsible for the quality of the job, and any testing that's done is done for the benefit of the owner. And anything that's missed is still the contractor's problem. The fact that the owner got a test that said that something was okay and it was later found out to not be okay doesn't get the contractor off the hook. And finally, the CA, well, not finally, but the next thing is the CA monitors the progress of the job against the schedule that was promised. I see we got another question here. Does the CA confirm quantities for payment? Absolutely. We'll look at that when we get to the payment schedule, but that is the prime function of the CA, is to certify which items are eligible to be paid. Does the contractor have the right to know who the CA is during the tender process and prior to the tender close? No. Because the owner's not obligated to appoint a CA until the notice of award. So that will be long after the tender has closed. And the reason for that is that the owner may not know who that CA is going to be. They might have engaged a firm, and they have an understanding that that firm will appoint or will provide a CA, but not know who that person is. And by the way, the CA is not a firm, the CA is a person, because there has to be an audit trail saying this person's signature is the one that authorizes things. So the owner may not know who the CA is going to be at the time of tendering. We've had numerous situations where there's a new development and they require ripping up existing road to hook up utilities. The developer contractor is responsible for rehab of the existing road in accordance. The road is repaired, and later upon review by the city road maintenance staff have found that the asphalt was not keyed in since the asphalt was 90 millimeters thick, which is a supplementary spec. Doesn't the developer's CA have a role to monitor and inspect to ensure the city is getting what the supplementary MMCD spec says? Well, if I understand the question correctly, the answer is no. The contractor is expected to know what the specifications are and to build in accordance with the specifications. And it's not up to the CA to do quality control for the contractor. If the contractor has been given a price to do something, then the contractor is expected to know what the specifications are to get paid. It's not up to the CA to determine that? Question from the audience here is, what happens if a CA changes during the course of a job and the new CA imposes different standards than the old one? The answer is, yes, the CA can do that. Again, coming back to the basic principle that the CA can do just about anything within the confines of the language. The more difficult question is, who pays? And the reality is that even if the CA didn't change, if the CA certified 100 meters of pavement last month, and you got paid for it, and then sometime in this month determined that actually 20 meters of that was deficient, that didn't come up to strength spec or whatever, then in this month's progress billing, they can put a negative 20 on last month's. So it doesn't even take a change in the CA. The important thing is that the CA is applying the rules of the contract that the contractor agreed to fulfill. Does the CA have the right not to pay unqualified works? I'm not sure what unqualified works means. If you mean that they're unsatisfactory, yes, that's the CA's job, is to determine the quality and only pay for work that meets the quality standards that are set in the specifications. So that's a prime prerogative of the CA's role. Continuing on with the functions of the CA, the CA is responsible to determine whether substantial and total performance have been met once the applications have come in. That's one of the major roles of the CA, is to determine when the job's done. The CA acts as the payment certifier for builder's lien for the contractor. Under the MMCD, any builder's lien releases that are between the contractor and a subcontractor is evaluated by the general contractor. It's not a matter for the CA or the owner. And owners sometimes have a problem with that. They say, well, we're now releasing holdback monies that we don't have any say in. Well, yes, that's the way it's written. If you don't like it, change the document. But that's the way it's written in the standard document. The CA makes initial decisions about items which may become disputes. We had a question from the audience here that what if there's a difference in interpretation? Well, if there's a difference in interpretation, the CA makes the initial judgment. And if the contractor doesn't like it, then the CA's rules must be followed, and the matter goes to dispute to decide what additional compensation may or may not be entitled. I think I've answered all the questions that are there at the moment. And finally, the CA is responsible to make sure that the owner has a full set of marked up drawings so that they can create as-builts. It's up to the contractor to collect that information and record it, and it's up to the CA to ensure that it's complete and accurate. So, that's the overall role of the CA. Now, the CA is not necessarily an inspector. On a small job, the CA might be the inspector as well. The point is, the CA is a mandatory role, but the inspectors are optional. You can do away with inspectors. Sorry, that's a poor choice of words. You can do without the inspectors. I'm sure some contractors would like to do away with some of them. You can do without inspectors, but you cannot do without the CA. You have to have a CA in place. If the inspectors are to be used, then the contractor is entitled to be notified in writing of the exact names of the people that are authorized to be inspectors, because those inspectors have a subset of the rights of the CA to direct work on the job, that they can issue field memos, they can judge quality, they can require additional testing. So the contractor has to know who has the authority to do that. So they can inspect work, reject work, order special inspections. But they do not have the CA's authority to sign progress billings, to sign substantial or total performance schedules. So basically things that deal with money and completeness are the prerogative of the CA. A lot of that stuff, the background work, will be done by an inspector to prepare the documents for the CA. But the inspector can't sign them. Okay, there's a few more questions from the online people. The CA ensures general conformance. What other inspections are required? The document sets out the inspections that are intended to be the baseline. If more testing is required, then owners can write supplementary specifications to detail what additional testing is going to be done for the owner's purpose. And that in this Platinum edition is called quality assurance testing. Quality control testing is what the contractor does to ensure that they're meeting spec all the way through. And we don't tell the contractor what they have to do. They make a business decision of their own, how much or any testing to do. If they want to rely on the owner's testing, then that's fine. They can do that. But they have no call to say to the owner, well, you should have tested more often, or I don't like your test results, or I'm not going to pull that all out because I think it's okay. They don't have any background information. They don't have any supporting data to prove their point. So it's not up to the MMCD to tell a contractor what testing they have to do for quality control. We've set out the quality assurance testing that are pretty normal, and if the owner needs more for specific circumstances, they can write supplementals. Okay, can a contract have two substantial performance dates? Okay, this comes back to the builder's lien thing. Yes, you can have multiple substantial performance dates, but the only one the owner cares about is the one for the general contract. So theoretically, every subcontractor could apply for substantial performance for their portion of the work and ask for release of their holdback, which would be judged by the general contractor, and the general contractor would issue a certificate of substantial performance for the work done by that subcontractor and would apply to the owner for release of the subcontractor's holdback money within 55 days. But the owner doesn't care about all these other dates. The only one that matters is when the CA issues substantial performance for the general contractor. So, let's now move on to talk about the superintendent. Not only is the superintendent a mandatory position, it's expected that that will be the same person that was listed in the tender documents, because supposedly that was part of the award decision that the owner made. The superintendent is required to be there for the full time where work is being done and may not be changed without permission of the owner. And again, that's because the expectation is the owner evaluated the superintendent's qualifications and ability at the time of tendering, and to allow a contractor to just change out or not even put in that person defeats the whole purpose of having that evaluation made. On the other hand, if it turns out that the superintendent is not performing well, the owner has the ability to require the contractor to change out the superintendent for somebody more suitable. The superintendent is responsible for almost everything on site. Because the owner has turned over the site to the contractor and the superintendent is the contractor's representative, then essentially everything that happens on site is the purview of that superintendent. The labor, the safety, the quality, the completeness, the schedule, everything. I mentioned that the CA is the focal point for communications between the general contractor and the owner. Similarly, the superintendent is the focal point for communications between the CA and the subcontractors. The CA should not be dealing with subcontractors on a direct basis. In fact, there's only one exception that we make, and that is the CA has the prerogative to release information on how much has been paid for certain work items for which the subcontractor may be responsible, so that the subcontractor has some idea of how much the owner has paid for work that they performed. That's the only time that the CA should be dealing directly with subcontractors. Now, I say that, and that's not right. There's one other time. Can anybody give me an idea when the CA might talk directly to a subcontractor or to subcontractors' forces on the job? Exactly. The answer is imminent danger. If you see something that is a risk, serious risk to safety or environment, then you must step in and take the minimum action necessary to put a halt to that situation until the appropriate authorities, whether it's the subcontractor's foreman or the superintendent, can come and deal with the matter. You can't walk by an imminent danger thing and say, well, I just don't have the authority. Okay. Back again to substantial performance dates. Can a second substantial performance be issued for a change order following the first substantial performance? You'd have to ask a lawyer on that one. My guess is that you probably cannot, because the substantial performance certificate is determined by law on the basis of criteria in the Builders Lien Act. And I don't think that you can issue a second one, but you'd have to get a legal opinion on that. Question. I believe the superintendent cannot be changed without the permission of the CA and not the owner. You might be right on that. It might be the CA's permission is required for a change in the superintendent. I'd have to look at the exact language. However, it's pretty much irrelevant because a smart CA would not require a change of the superintendent without getting the owner's backing to start with. Now, there's a question here, payment dispute question mark, but I don't know what the question is. Okay. Imminent danger. Yeah, all right. No, when it comes to payment disputes, the CA doesn't get in the matter between the general and the subs. They have to work that out for themselves. So I said earlier, I'm sorry, yes, go ahead.
In the case where, let's say, a superintendent whoever the contractor is, the contractor can provide as an alternate or replacement superintendent.
Okay, the question is, what if the superintendent leaves to take another job during the course of this contract? Can the owner terminate if they don't like the proposed replacement? The answer is not immediately. The contractor is obliged to provide a superintendent whose competence is acceptable to the owner. And if the owner chooses, or if the owner determines that the replacement is not, then they can go through the process of saying, that's not good enough, you have to get somebody acceptable, and then you, if it continued, you would get into the breach of contract provisions, and there's certain notice periods and response periods and things. So technically you could for breach of contract, but it's a fairly drawn-out process. Okay, so some of the functions of the superintendents. Responsible for daily compliance with all contract quality and schedule terms, for the competency of all workers and the quality of all material. The specific language in GC411 says, to effectively direct and supervise the work so as to ensure conformance with the contract documents. To ensure conformance, those are the keys. There's no out on that. The superintendent is responsible for all site safety, for workers and subcontractors, for other people on site, the owner's forces, utility crews, other people that may be working on site, and for the public. And as part of that, to manage the prime contractor responsibilities imposed by WorkSafe BC as flowed through by the language in our document. Superintendents responsible for the means and methods of construction, the assignment of all the labor, equipment and materials that are required, and for sequencing and keeping to schedule. They're responsible to organize all testing that's required, to either do it or to organize it and coordinate with the CA about it. Responsible to respond to requests for quotations put out by the CA, and for providing and updating schedules, and internally to keep the contractor's own records to support claims or defend against back charges. Subcontractors. It's not mandatory to have subcontractors, but if they're there, then they need to be the ones that were approved at the time of tender. However, the owner can demand a change. If the owner wants the subcontractor changed prior to award, then the contractor can do so, providing it doesn't affect the time or cost of the job. After the job has been awarded, the owner can still require a change of the subcontractor, but at that time, then any additional costs would be subject to being covered by a change order. Subcontractors are required to comply with the contract just as if they were the general. They're responsible to provide competent employees, to provide a schedule and adhere to it, and to live with the payment terms that the owner has set out. All direction and formal communication must come from the superintendent, and it's important that the CA do not give directions or instructions without going through the superintendent, but could provide payment information, as I mentioned, and that any builder's lien matters, substantial performance, is dealt with by the superintendent.